This is an ABC podcast.
The role of the coroner inquest is to shine a light on when things go horribly wrong, to identify failings, including systemic failings, to ensure that there's learning from this so that it does not happen again.
Learning from tragedy. Hi, Damien Carrick here. This is The Law Report. Today we analyse the recommendations of two significant coronial inquests.
In a statement, Police Commissioner Mick Fuller said New South Wales Police take responsibility for the deaths of Jack and Jennifer Edwards in 2018. It comes days after a coroner found the New South Wales Firearms Registry failed when it granted John Edwards gun licences despite his history of domestic violence. The children were killed by their father, John Edwards, at the Sydney home they shared with their mother, Olga Edwards.
I must warn you, this first conversation is harrowing. On the 5th of July 2018, John Edwards murdered his two children, 15-year-old Jack and 13-year-old Jennifer, before then killing himself. John Edwards was a man with a long, well-documented history of violence. So were the deaths of the teenage siblings avoidable? Last week, New South Wales State Coroner Teresa O'Sullivan found that the deaths of Jack and Jennifer were preventable, and she identified a series of systemic failures which contributed to the crimes. Liz Snell is the Law Reform and Policy Coordinator with the Women's Legal Service New South Wales.
There were three key failings the coroner identified. Firstly, with the police response to Olga's, the mother of Jack and Jennifer's, her reports of domestic violence perpetrated against her children and herself by John Edwards. Secondly, there were systemic failings in regards to how John Edwards came to obtain a gun licence. And thirdly, there was significant failings with regards to family law proceedings, with a particular focus on the role of the independent children's lawyer.
Well, let's talk about all of those in a moment. Tell me, who was John Edwards?
So John Edwards, he perpetrated domestic violence against six of his former partners and eight other children. And four of his ex-partners had reported domestic violence to police, and three AVOs had been taken out in protection of three of his ex-partners.
That's apprehended violence orders.
Apprehended violence orders. And also one of his adult children, who also reported to police being abused by her father as a child, she also sought a domestic violence protection order in response to her father stalking her as an adult.
He was married to Olga and they had two children, 15-year-old Jack and 13-year-old Jennifer. How did the two teenagers die?
The two teenagers were killed by their father on the 5th of July 2018 in their home at West Pennant Hills. Olga had separated from John 2 years earlier, and Olga and her children had moved to a new address for safety concerns, which hadn't been disclosed to their father. So John stalked his daughter and followed her home. He shot the children. It was calculated and premeditated.
So John Edwards kills these two children on the 5th of July 2018, and then, overcome with grief, Olga ends her own life on the 12th of December 2018. So this is an absolutely dreadful tragedy. Coming back to the findings of the coroner, what did the coroner have to say about New South Wales Police?
So the coroner found that the central deficiency in the police response was that Olga interacted with two inexperienced police officers on two separate occasions, and I can talk you through those occasions in a minute. And one police officer had very experience in another team, but because of school holidays was in the general duties team. And on the second incident, it was an officer who was only 6 months into their role. So if I can talk you through the first instance, Olga went to the police on the 29th of December in 2016. Olga reported domestic violence being perpetrated against her children on three occasions by their father. The police failed to record that information correctly in a whole range of ways. So, for example, they listed Olga as the victim and not the children, and that's important because if children are listed as the victim or present, there's further and separate mandatory reports that need to take place.
Which might lead to an apprehended violence order.
Absolutely. They also, which is relevant to that point too, is it was entered as a domestic violence no offence when it should have been entered as an assault domestic violence, which again would then lead to an apprehended violence order application. There were also a whole range of questions that police, as part of their domestic violence risk assessment screening process, they ask several questions. So first of all, the children were noted as not being present. Secondly, there was no inquiry made about firearms, which is relevant given that the children were ultimately killed through guns. In the narrative field, the police officer talked about holding no fears of safety and a belief that maybe it was a premeditated attempt to influence divorce proceedings.
On Olga's behalf, she was trying to kind of pollute the waters of John. That's the allegation.
That's indeed the implication made there.
So that's the first incident. What about the second incident?
The second incident involved a stalking incident, and in the early morning on the 8th of February in 2017, Olga went to her usual yoga class. She was lying down, and then when she stood up for the start of the class and looked in the mirror, she noticed that John, her ex-partner, was standing 2 metres behind her. So she quickly left and went straight to the police station to report that. Because, as I mentioned, it was a relatively new constable, they didn't necessarily understand all the issues that she was identifying as stalking. The police officer noted in their police record that the ex-husband didn't talk to her and there was no physical contact.
But I believe the police officer did call John Edwards, but he suggested that he'd been to many such yoga classes and what, no problem, nothing to see here. But then the police officer didn't cross-check the stories of Olga and John with the yoga school, who could have told the officer he found him very, very creepy.
Yes, indeed. That was a significant failing on that part. Proper investigation could have established that this was a stalking offence.
So there were failures by New South Wales Police in the way they dealt with the concerns raised by Olga about her safety and that of her children. What did the coroner have to say about the access to firearms that John Edwards had?
Primarily, the firearms issue was about improving the regulation framework in relation to issuing of firearm licences. So there's a couple of processes that need to happen when issuing a gun licence. And it seemed that the firearm registry were very much focused on aspects which would lead to a mandatory refusal of a firearm. And one of those aspects was if they'd been the subject of an AVO over the last 10 years. But there was also a fit and proper person test and a trusted person test, which didn't get the attention that it should have. And it was found that there were systemic failings with the firearms registry because they didn't have policies and processes. So in effect, what happened was John had applied for a gun license in 2010. He was asked, was he the subject of an AVO in the previous 10 years? He answered no. And the coroner found that he had answered that question and provided false and misleading information because he did have an AVO taken out against him by one of his ex-partners in 2000. So in 2010, that would have still been within the 10 years. Also, they didn't have systems in the registry about marking on the computer system if someone was making a misleading and false application. And also, they didn't have mechanisms in place, and there was insufficient training for staff in understanding domestic violence as well, so that they didn't know effectively how to check for a DV history. And that was very significant because John had a history, a 24-year history of significant domestic violence. So that should have been very significant red flags to the question of was he a fit and proper person to hold a gun license.
The coroner also focused on a third area, and that was the role of the independent children's lawyer in the family law proceedings. What does an independent children's lawyer do, and what was the focus of the coroner's concerns with the role of this lawyer?
In part, their role is to assist the child to be heard in family law proceedings. They have a requirement as part of the independent children's lawyers' guidelines to seek the views of children and to present these before the court if the child wants their wishes to be considered. The coroner found that the independent children's lawyer contravened the independent children's law guidelines in several ways and over an extended period of time.
How so?
She failed to ensure the court had been fully informed of Jack and Jennifer's views, or alternatively, to the extent that she was relying on discussions with them, she failed to ensure that that material she relied on was inadmissible form. She also failed to bring to the court's attention the views of Jack and Jennifer that had been expressed to the family consultant and the family therapist, and that was that the children said that they didn't want to have contact with their father. The independent children's lawyer also failed to ensure that her views and attitudes relating to the issues before the court were supported by evidence and not a personal view, and there was concerns about how the independent children's lawyer had categorised police response as suggesting it was heavy-handed parenting when they're in the view of the coroner, that it was opinion that was not factually based.
In other words, she was of the view that John's parenting was heavy-handed as opposed to physically and emotionally abusive.
Yes. It was also found that by the time of the interim hearing that happened on the 22nd of December in 2016, the coroner was satisfied that there was significant evidence within the independent children's lawyer permit that indicated that John Edwards did have a history of violence and that Jack and Jennifer did not want to see him. And that evidence included there was a child-inclusive conference memorandum to the court prepared by the family consultant. There was a letter provided by a private family therapy that raised family violence concerns. There was Olga's evidence herself through her affidavit from the 6th of April, which talked about the violence perpetrated against the children. There was John's affidavits, which admitted hitting and yelling at Jack on a number of occasions and describing it as parenting, playful or accidental, but admitted that it happened. And also there was the evidence through the subpoena of police at that stage too. So there was evidence to suggest that there was family violence concerns. And the independent children's lawyer said on that occasion that she didn't have any concerns in relation to family violence.
So there have been these findings which have identified failures on behalf of New South Wales Police, the Firearms Registry, and also the independent children's lawyer. Liz Snell, for you, what are the most important recommendations of the coroner?
I think there's been some really important recommendations made in regards to police, and in particular the auditing of compliance with the domestic violence standing operating procedures and indeed with responding to reports to police of sexual violence and domestic violence. The auditing recommendation is very important, as are the training recommendations. It's particularly important that all police have extensive and ongoing training in domestic violence, because domestic violence sadly is very prevalent and such a key important part of police work. So training is also very important.
What about the way the family law system operates?
So the recommendation that the coroner made with respect to that was that the Office of the Legal Services Commissioner investigate whether any disciplinary action ought to be taken against the ICL in the matter.
So you have these findings about New South Wales Police, the Firearms Registry and the family law system, in particular the independent children's lawyer. We have the performance of different people within their roles, but you also have different systems not necessarily communicating with each other, and that contributed to John Edwards being able to find cracks in the systems and move through them. Is that a way of looking at what took place?
I think that's a very fair assessment, Damien, and indeed some of the recommendations that have been made too is about information sharing mechanisms occurring. So, for example, when a family law court is aware through notice of risks or other mechanisms about family violence allegations or allegations of child abuse, that they would alert the police so that the police are aware of that from the perspective of if there is going to be someone applying for a fire licence. And similarly, if there are people applying for firearm licences, that police, if they're aware that the family law proceedings are happening too, that there's a mechanism for that sharing to go the other way back to the family law courts. So certainly there are systemic issues in terms of there needing to be mechanisms where information such as that is shared.
What do you take away from the finding of the New South Wales coroner that the deaths of Jennifer and Jack were preventable?
I think it's an incredibly sad example that the deaths of Jack and Jennifer could have been prevented. And really, that just goes to highlight the incredible importance of a policing response and of all players in the family law matters, very comprehensively understanding domestic violence, including particularly coercive and controlling violence. And that's really important if we're to prevent this from happening again.
Liz Snell, Law Reform and Policy Coordinator with the Women's Legal Service of New South Wales, thank you for speaking to the Law Report.
Thanks, Damien.
And if you or someone you know is affected by this program, contact Respect. The National Helpline is 1800 737 732. That's Respect. Hotline 1800 737 732.
You're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National with Damien Carrick. Available anywhere, anytime, via the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now to the other major coronial findings that have just been handed down. Victorian coroner Perez Espanos investigated the drug-related deaths of five young men who died in separate incidents between July 2016 and January 2017. She's recommended the adoption of pill testing and an early warning system to alert the public about dangerous substances being used in the manufacture of illicit drugs. Deakin University criminologist Dr. Andrew Groves says all five deceased consumed drugs that were laced with adulterants.
The coronial inquest was into five young men who ranged in age from 17 to 32, so Anson, Jason, Ilka, Jordan and James. Though there were some differences in terms of the experiences that they had with their substance use and ultimately what happened, essentially what each of these young men engaged in was some form of illicit drug use. All five consumed substances that contained two novel psychoactive substances, so otherwise known as NPSs. And the problem with NPSs is that we don't know a lot about them. And so the issue for each of these five young men and the reasons that were identified in the coronial inquest was that there were two key substances which colloquially are known as 25C and also Forfa, which are two NPSs that are incredibly dangerous. Both of those substances were in each of the drugs that the five young men consumed that ultimately led to the fatal level of toxicity in their system and led to cardiac arrest and their ultimate death.
So all five of them thought that they were consuming a certain kind of drug, but in fact what they were consuming was something which was laced with adulterants.
Correct, or more potent, depending on the chemical composition.
Can we talk about the five young men and actually what happened to them? I mean, I understand that one of them, James, actually died because he, under the influence of these drugs, he had hallucinations and jumped from the balcony of a 10th floor apartment.
Yeah, that's correct. Unfortunately, all five died as a result of consuming these drugs. For four of them, their death was attributed in the coronial inquest to the toxicity associated with the chemical composition, and in particular, the presence of these two NPSs.
And then what led to what? Respiratory failure?
So upon consuming the substances, they started behaving very erratically. They had hallucinations, flashbacks. They appeared quite distressed. They were acting very out of character. Some engaged in sort of physical movements such as head-butting furniture or walls and so on. And then that led to a seizure and then cardiac failure and then respiratory failure, and all four passed away as a result of that. In the fifth case, James, as you mentioned, he similarly engaged in very strange behaviour, appeared quite agitated, and then as a result of that behaviour, unfortunately, jumped off of a 10th-storey balcony. So it's difficult to say that all five were exactly the same, but essentially they demonstrated similar behaviours that ultimately led to their deaths, and that's what was attributed in the coronial inquest.
And in the view of the coroner, why and how might pill testing prevent similar deaths?
Well, essentially, and this is what was identified by Coroner Spanos, pill testing as well as an early warning system or early warning network would help to reduce the harms associated with this type of drug use, as well as potentially prevent these and or other similar deaths by identifying in advance the composition, the nature and level of substances in these pills or tablets or powders that these young people are consuming. And the process of pill testing would likely have identified the presence of these two NPSs, and hopefully they would be a really significant red flag for these young people to prevent taking them, in addition to identifying adulterants such as NPSs like Forfa and 25C. What it would also do is identify the purity or potency of a particular substance, or alternatively, that actually what they're taking is what they're expecting. So if, for instance, they're expecting to take GHB and then it's actually MDMA, that's going to have a significant difference in outcome for that individual. And so simply knowing that has been shown in both Australian and international research to significantly influence young people's behaviour around the use of illicit drugs.
What form would this pill testing take? I mean, what, would there be some kind of laboratory that you could kind of drop your pills off at and get them tested? Is that what is being envisaged in the Victorian coroner's recommendations?
Given that the five young people who were the centre of this coronial investigation consumed these substances in essentially private residences and not at music festivals, as was the case in New South Wales in recent years, I think what is being proposed here is slightly different from what has been proposed elsewhere. So there were two different models, if you like, in regards to pill testing. There are on-site, more ad hoc testing facilities, and they're typically more transportable. So, for instance, at music festivals, nightclubs, there might be a testing facility such as a drug bus, something like that, where they can test certain substances and provide feedback to users actually at those events. However, on the second alternative, and that's what is probably more proposed here by the findings from Coroner Spanis's report, is for a fixed site testing facility. So it would be a laboratory testing facility run by a range of scientists that individuals would provide samples to. So, for instance, if they might walk in off the street or they might present for investigation their substances, they would get it tested at the facility, and the information from that testing would then either be presented back to the individual themselves if they do provide contact details. Obviously, there are some issues there around privacy, and we know that young people in particular are quite reluctant to provide their details given that what they're engaging in is essentially a criminal behaviour. So they might receive that individual information. Alternatively, the information obtained from that testing might be used in public health alerts to more broadly through the health service. And so more widely, they can say, in Victoria, there is an issue with drugs that are laced with forfa, for example, and therefore people are aware of some of the challenges with various substances that are being circulated in the drug network in Victoria.
Coroner Spanos has made these recommendations, and the Victorian government, I think, is going to consider them. Now, north of the border in New South Wales, back in 2019, the New South Wales coroner recommended pill testing be conducted in that jurisdiction. And that was after her inquest into six drug-related deaths of people aged between 18 and 23 at music festivals over two summers. But the New South Wales Premier, Gladys Berejiklian, has very much said, no, that will not happen in this jurisdiction. What's her argument?
Well, essentially, Gladys Berejiklian's argument is that the implementation or even merely the debate around pill testing would actually be seen to be condoning illicit drug use. And so she and her government are very much of the view that pill testing is inappropriate because it sends the wrong message to the community saying that drugs are okay or that they are safe. And the other feature of her argument is that it goes against essentially the vast majority of her government's policy around drugs and their criminalisation. So, for instance, in New South Wales, there is a real strong law enforcement, zero tolerance approach to illicit drugs. And so her argument is that to be seen to be supporting pill testing would go against all of the hard work that they have done in that jurisdiction for a long period of time.
But also, I think the Premier is very much focused on the idea of safety. This will not make drug taking safer because individuals respond differently to drugs, and it sends a false message about safety if you have this testing.
Yeah, and I think one of the key issues here, and certainly as a drug scholar and researcher, it's important to note that this notion of safety is a really tenuous one. And so one of the key messages of pill testing is not about making drugs safe, because it is not possible.
They are not safe. Let's be clear.
Yeah, exactly. They are certainly not safe. And that's one of the key messages that actually comes through the pill testing discourse and also the services that pill testing provide. But I understand the concern of the New South Wales Premier and indeed many other voices in the community that, of course, this is not about projecting an imagery of safety. Drug use is not safe. However, what pill testing is able to do is able to provide some guidance and information about what young people are consuming to make better, more rational decisions, and also to pair them with health providers and to start that conversation about perhaps desisting from the use of illicit drugs. And I think that's what's really important. But I understand Gladys Berejiklian's argument. However, the research has shown that particularly in countries such as the Netherlands and Austria, that engaging in harm reduction initiatives such as pill testing, it has not actually increased the level of use among the community. And in fact, they've actually seen a reduction in overall levels of drug use as a result of pill testing because of the increase in drug awareness and drug education for a whole cohort of young people that are engaging in this activity.
Now, Andrew Goes, there has been one trial in Australia, or two, I think, both in the ACT, and they had pill testing, I think, at one-day music festivals in both 2018 and 2019. Will pill testing continue in that jurisdiction?
Obviously, it's hard to say, but I think it's a really good first step that it was possible to trial pill testing in the ACT at Groove in the Mood in 2018 and 2019. I think the reports that have come out of those two trials have been quite positive. Of course, the challenge with any findings from any trial is to work out or to identify what works. And certainly as part of what has arguably been a very contentious debate, you have to be really careful about articulating or defining what is effective or what works. And in this case, I think even though they were relatively small samples, the outcomes have been quite positive in the sense that particularly in the, I believe it was the 2019 second trial at Groove in the Moo, they found seven substances that were incredibly dangerous and that were discarded as a result of the pill testing service. And so essentially, you could argue that that's seven substances that were no longer consumed, that's potentially seven lives that were potentially saved as a result of the pill testing service. And I think that's what's really important. And the challenge in this space is that those two trials in the ACT, unfortunately, the information wasn't actually shared in real time with festival attendees, which limits the harm minimisation benefit, if you like, of pill testing.
What are the next steps in Victoria? I mean, the government says it will consider these recommendations. Is that where we're at?
It's a really tough question, Damien, because I think, I mean, as was noted in the coroner's report, the Victorian government has come to the table, if you like, with the second of the recommendations, which was that of the early warning system or early warning network, bearing in mind the existing strategies and frameworks or approaches that they already have in Victoria. However, the Victorian government has been quite firm about the first recommendation, and that is pill testing. And so currently, I don't think the Victorian government has an appetite for pill testing. I think the challenge there is that we need to be open in this debate and we need to be driven by the evidence. And certainly what the coroner's report is identifying and certainly what both Australian and international research is suggesting is that pill testing and early warning detection systems are really effective in reducing the harms associated with the consumption of illicit drugs and certainly have the capacity to reduce fatalities such as those that were the basis for the coronial inquest.
Andrew Groves, a criminologist at Deakin University, thank you for speaking to the Law Report.
No worries, thank you very much.
That's the program. Thanks to producer Anita Barrow and to sound engineer Matthew Sigley. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time with more Law.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.